Sly and the Family Stone. There's a Riot Gone On became number one on this day in 1971. Still like to listen to Sly. I guess because I'm just old, but I like to listen to Sly anyway. The star of our panel, we have in the studio with us, speaking of old, Michael Johnson, Executive Director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change, joins us. The Reverend Meredith Moyes joins us, ordained minister, writer, community activist, and teacher, one of the first black women ordained in the old Catholic movement here in Baltimore City. Currently a climate organizer for Maryland Clean Energy and Climate Advocacy Organization, but she's not here in that capacity. Munir Bahar is with us, activist and founder of Core Fitness, one of the organizers of the 300-Man March. Devon Love, director of research and policy, public policy for Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join in the conversation. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation. So we have reached a peak. The more murders in the streets of Baltimore than it has been in 4 years. 224 people to this moment, unless something happened in the last 24 hours that I'm not aware of, have died in the streets of Baltimore from gun violence. There's this young man, Surreal Scott, 20 years old, was killed on Liberty Heights near Mondawmin. His parents said they loved their kid. They named him Sir and Real when he was born, and they described him as funny and mild-mannered, a great father to his five-year-old son. Nobody's sure why he was killed, what he did. Parents say he wasn't involved in anything deep. You know, what happened to him? He's gone. His little boy has no father. So I'm just curious how you think, you know, overall, as we get into more specifics here on what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. And we talk about this over and over again over the years, but I really want to know what you think, how you think we should be responding to this. I mean, if you actually had the reins of power, if you had the reins of power in this city, what would you do? What would your response be? If all of a sudden you turn up and say, okay, I ran Devon Love and I became the mayor, president of city council, or whatever, you know, something happened and you were there. What would be your response to what seems like an intractable problem?
Well, I think a part of what we see in the neighborhoods experience, the kinds of violence that we're talking about this morning, has a lot to do with the lack of investment, not just in the communities as you know, entities that have services for those that live in those communities, but investment in the structures of the families in those communities. And I think what you'll find is that, you know, I actually had a conversation last night with some folks talking about, you know, schooling and education. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we talked about was that, you know, what we don't have is we don't have, particularly, you know, black folks in Baltimore and many of the communities that are most troubled, the kind of familial connections that, you know, a lot of, you know, elders that are mentors to me talk about, that was really the fabric of the community that helped to be its own protection against that kind of violence. And I think, you know, for folks of, you know, my generation and younger have no, you know, context for that. You know, we've never seen a community that was invested in, you know, not just in terms of public policy, but in terms of, you know, those who have the means to make a difference. You know, and I think, you know, what's really important and what these deaths, I think, demonstrate is the importance of communities themselves beginning to invest in themselves, invest in creating that social network, so that the institutions necessary in the community to protect folks from that kind of violence can be something that's sustainable, that it's not a flash in the pan, it's not, you know, an event, it's something that's a sustainable, institutionalized part of the community to build the structures necessary to help protect ourselves against that kind of violence.
I'm going to come back and probe a little deeper about this idea. Munir, let me let you jump in next.
Hey, you know, I'm a general. This is about war. We are facing a war. Anytime you're confronted with a serious challenge, especially in circumstances where it seems insurmountable, and I mean right now in Baltimore with the murder rates climbing, it's like, you know, with everybody doing everything, you know, in their respective pockets, the murder rate is still, you know, climbing. So this is a serious issue that in the case of war has to be tackled with extreme discipline. I mean, you know, there are measures that we can take. I mean, for you know, I come from a different perspective. I don't care what nobody else is not doing. I don't care if there are no institutions. I don't care if there's no this, no this, no that. I look at what we can do. There needs to be some measures of extreme discipline that have to take place within our community. things like no video games that are violent, no movies that are violent, no this, no that. There are many things we can cut out as community members that will reduce the likelihood of our young people engaging in violence, but our young folks are being conditioned to violence at an early age. But for the sake of free trade, for the sake of I have the right to do this or do this, we accept things into our culture that cultivate violent mentality. So in the lack of access and resources to this or that, families, people, folks listening to the radio right now, how do we contain this violent nature from contaminating our young people? Because what's going on now, those who are violent right now are going to be violent. But how do we stop the next generation, the 5 to 15-year-olds, from becoming the next wave of violent offenders? And it's extreme measures. I mean, I'm sorry, with 224 murders, there's nothing normal about it. There's nothing, let's talk about. No, this is an extreme situation, so extreme measures must be taken. My belief.
Firstly, this is a public health emergency. And what I see as someone who has taught high school here and in Prince George's is there is a direct link to the mental health of people, and violence is a symptom of that. And I think that we really need to start looking at, I don't understand why the rec centers are disappearing, but other people are getting tax breaks to build homes for the rich. The lack of jobs is direct, you know, that correlation of unemployment can be directly correlated to the amount of hopelessness that people have. So we have to start investing in that in our school system. Many of the folks that are out here doing these things, they've dropped out of school. And why are they dropping out of school? They're dropping out of schools for many reasons. So we need to look at this from a multidisciplinary perspective. And ultimately, you know, as a minister and just as a person of faith, I see a spirit of hopelessness and complacency that has descended upon this city. And as people, whether you believe or not, we have to come together and decide that this can't happen here. And I don't see the public will. Where there is a will, there's a way. I don't see the public will to change this. I see it in pockets and individuals. But on a public scheme of things, I don't see it. I find it very interesting, and we'll get into this later in the show, that there seems to be money for all sorts of things, except for the poor. I was in front of the casino. I was going to Annapolis and was in front of the casino that literally has been going up overnight. But there is no money to invest in our children. There's no money to create job programming. There's no money to build homes for the poor, to even rehab half the city, which is literally falling down around us. But there's money to build a casino, which after it is built, 5 to 7 years for that to actually keep it running. And then when they build that casino in National Harbor down in PG, the bottom's going to drop out. Nobody's coming to Baltimore to gamble if you can go down to D.C. or go to Delaware. So where are our priorities? Is it about empowering the wealthy and then everybody else? Well, you just take a hike. When do we say enough is enough?
Wow.
Michael Johnson.
Well, it's hard. I mean, all of these are actually where we should be. I mean, you know, from the original question of what you do is, you know, you have to have a Marshall Plan, you know, similar to what the Marshall Plan was about. First thing you have to do is you have to admit you have a problem. We have a tendency in this city to act like everything's fine. Everything's okay. You know, if we just would do this or do that, but we have to have a Marshall Plan. We have to identify what are our areas. Some of the areas that were spoken around the table in reference to violent games and stuff like that. Well, you can also connect that with lack of food in our community. People aren't eating real food, which goes back to mental health. So if you've got an opportunity, there's a gas station on Park Circle that when you walk into the gas station, they're selling nods and crack pipes right in front of you. And so when we went to, they'll go and discuss, it's the gas station right next to something chicken, right next to the place, and we asked the guy, and he says, well, I put them up there because they're selling. So if we're not going to admit that we have problems in our schools, if we're not going to admit we have problems in our community, if we're not going to admit we have no food, if we're not going to admit we have lack of housing, if we have to admit that the neighborhoods are not neighborhoods anymore. You know, when people say neighborhoods and say what services used to be a long time ago when Mark and I were younger, a lot of services was because of segregation. Be clear. A lot of services for the African-American community is because of segregation, because nobody else was going to do it for yourself but yourself. So what we have to do is start turning in what communities are left. But to suggest that we have neighborhoods where you had a Miss Jackson or we had rec centers or programs that would run to be entrepreneur programs, because everybody around this table is doing something. But what we need to do is pull everybody around these tables and others to do others.
So let me get a quick phone call here that I'm going to kind of probe what everybody said here and see if we can kind of pull this in and find some of the reality and contradictions of what we just heard from all of you. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts. You're mayor for a day. Steve in Baltimore, you're on the air. Steve, you're on the air. You're not there, Steve?
Hello?
You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I was glad, Mr. Johnson, that you were discussing the Marshall Plan, because I had been in a couple community meetings where you had got in depth about that.
Mm-hmm.
I missed a few points. So could you get a little more in depth about it, how everything ties in, the mental health issues and the economic issues, and part of the reason that the black community has not been fully developed, because each time there is some type of plan since the late 50s, the funds have always disappeared when the programs have been started. So the programs within itself throughout our communities to create a real community like the other communities is missing. Can you give me some more insight on that?
Well, I'm quite sure during this conversation, everybody will be able to add up. And thank you very much. One of the things that we want to be able to recognize again is that when you talk about a Marshall Plan, you really need to talk about first identifying the problems and then having a realistic solution. I think you made the good point, and I think my sister has made the point in her presentation, is that each time we build something new, then we should be building something old or rebuilding something old. It's something wrong with the fact that you drive past Russell Street and you've seen this building go up like in a day. Literally, every time you go by, you go in a day. But it's taken us almost 40 years to build a new school in the city of Baltimore. But yet, rec centers are being torn down, but yet new rec centers are being built for new people, for new dollars, and new communities. So, you know, and I'll let Mark, you know, obviously ask most of the question, but at the end of the day, if we don't have a plan to first say what's wrong and be honest with it and say what's wrong instead of saying all of the things of what's right.
Well, I just very quickly, where is this new community center being built that you're talking about?
Anything that's being built down at the harbor, all of the new stuff being the harbor connects to the new parks.
Okay. Right.
Oh, yeah, they got new parks, swimming pool, basketball courts for me and you, Mark.
I'm not aware of all that. I'm really not aware of all that.
No, but I'm saying if you ever look at the plan,
Not being built with city money to build.
But if you're giving them tax reliefs in order to build it, right, in order for other people.
So the question is, though, you know, we always, and I just push a little bit, that what you were saying a little bit about, and it ties into what you all were saying as well, sometimes I think it's a danger talking about the good old days.
Yes.
Because there really were not good old days.
No.
I mean, the good old days were, the only time it was good about them was because people had jobs. Whether they were working in a box factory or the steel mill, the majority of people, there were a lot of working people in the community. Every time I drive through these desolate neighborhoods right now, when I was younger, these neighborhoods were filled with people living in those homes, running up and down the street, people living their lives, sitting on the stoop, hanging out, having barbecues outside. People knew each other. There were communities. Whether they were poor, it was segregated, there was, as I said, poverty. There was still some violence in the street, but not like this. Mm-hmm. They were tough, but it was different. So, but harkening back to the good old days doesn't take us to where we need to get to in the future sometimes.
Well, it depends how far your good old days want to go back, Mark. I mean, there's a period in Baltimore City, as you know, and I know, where because the neighborhoods were solid, because the school systems were better, we were sending more people to college in the African American community during so-called segregation.
I'm not sure then that's we said, true.
Well, you know,
not, no, that is not true.
Let's put it like
those
this.
Those stats are not true, man.
Well, you know, let's put it like this. In relationship to the people that I know,
right.
More people went to college than are going to college today.
Well, if I can add on to that, because I think the larger point is that when we talk about what the solution is to the problems that we're talking about,
yeah.
I find that most of the solutions that people propose requires intervention from folks that are external to the community as a necessary part of that change. And I think that's the problem, is that I think people assume that the solutions come from without instead of empowering the assets that the community has from within. And I think it's really important because if we look at the history of the last 40, 50 years, we look at what we call integration and we look at, you know, many of, you know, Department of Social Services, no one would say that they've been effective at empowering those that they're tasked with serving. You know, many of the institutions that were formed with the purposes of improving the quality of education of people of African descent that, you know, most of these institutions have not been effective at doing so. And the fundamental paradigm that they've approached that with is that the external folks coming in to fix, you know, these people that, you know, don't know how to manage their affairs without understanding that there are historical and structural things that have been happening to Black folks that have undermined the viability of the institutions that gave us the vibrance that I think, you know, Mr. Johnson is talking about. This isn't to say that we want to go back to the era of segregation,
mm-hmm, right.
But it is to say that there were certain mechanisms that segregation forced Black folks to have to adhere to that were positive for the development of the community. And I think what we want to do is use some of the lessons that taught us that it were instructive and help implement that today. And I think a part of the problem is that the conversation about racism and white supremacy in our society is at a very rudimentary level in mm-hmm. the public discourse, right? Because when we say things like Black folks should have independent institutions, people get really nervous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people think that means, oh, you must hate white people or you must, you know, not want people from the outside coming in, when it really means what it means for any other people. You know, it just means that, you know, if you're going to have a community that serves folks who are of Korean descent, then it should be Korean folks that control those institutions because they have the historical and institutional memory that it takes to produce productive citizens from that vantage point. And so likewise, for Black folks, I think there needs to be that same consideration.
I think also, too, that one of the things that I look at is that the church or I'll say spiritual institutions that are traditionally in the African-American community and affected areas, we've dropped the ball. I've done some climate canvasses off of North Avenue in West Baltimore near Walbrook Junction. And so when you go back behind North Avenue, you can literally see five spiritual institutions in a block and a half. Meanwhile, the neighborhoods are literally falling down around them. And sometimes walking through those neighborhoods, it's like walking through a ghost town. I'm waiting to see the tumbleweed, but the tumbleweed comes in form of people that are literally broken. So I'm looking at the churches like, is there a way that we can have a doctor or mental health therapist on staff to start with? Is there a way that this church from Monday through Friday can turn into a food distribution center? I'm not talking about soup kitchen. I'm talking about we have real live produce and fresh food at this location. I mean, there are ways, multi-purpose ways that we can use these institutions because this is a very crazy situation where you have one part of the city that is being expanded and others that are literally falling down. It's very jarring to the soul. And can you imagine being a child in that community and the energy it takes to get up and walk past all of these falling down buildings to go to a school that's also falling down? What do we expect from our children if this is where we're putting them?
We're going to take a brief break. Michael Scott's in line. We're going to get to your call, Michael, and Clarence and Brother Khalik, 410-319-8888. Come back and let Monir jump in and probe some of these things in greater depth. Your thoughts. We're going to go out here. Jimmy Logan, James Brown's a great lead guitarist. We're going to go out with Wipe Your Tears.
Oh, well, I don't love you, baby. Why keep on hanging around? No, I don't love you, baby. Why? Because.
this day in 1977, Stephen Biko was tortured to death by the South African police. And that is Peter Gabriel with his song, Biko. We're back with our panel here, 410-319-8888. Dave Von Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Michael Johnson, Executive Director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Change, Social Change. The Reverend Meredith Moyes, ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, and one of the first black women ordained in the Old Catholic Church. Munir Bahar, activist and founder of Core Fitness, one of the organizers of the 300-man march. Munir.
Yeah, a couple things, man. You know, when we talk about this conversation of violence, and, you know, I come from a martial arts and a sort of spiritual background. You know, I don't look at it as a black thing. I mean, I'm not going to look at what's going on in Baltimore City in isolation and what's going on in the world and has been going on in the world for thousands of years. And it's just, you know, in every culture, you have groups of people within that culture who get sick and find it okay to kill each other. And I think if we limit it to just a black experience and that this is a black problem, it's almost becomes that it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now we start, as black people, we start thinking, oh, we kill each other. We not the only ones killing each other. If we look around the globe right now, this violence, this epidemic of killing people, of molesting children, of selling people into slavery, all this foolishness and madness that cripples the fabric of humanity is going on everywhere. So we have to even expand our consciousness and look at why are humans suffering? Why are humans killing each other? It is not just a Baltimore problem. It is not just a black problem. You go to any poor Latino community, it is the same thing. They have just as many gangs, just as many drug dealers, just as many guns in every every poor community. Has it. So it's a matter of economics, but it's not just a black thing. I don't like when our conversation always gets to what black people got to do. It's not just what we have to do. It's what human beings, period, have to do, because our solution is also a solution in this community or that community or this community. We can learn from Japan. We can learn from Argentina. We can learn from Ireland. We can learn from everywhere. It's a human problem. It's not a black. I don't accept it as a black problem, even here in Baltimore City, because we are affected by things that do not have prejudices. Drugs don't care what color you are. You know, poverty doesn't care what color you are. Now, yes, there's some historical things that have affected black people, but we're not the only ones suffering. We're not the only ones who have taken the L in society. And so as black people, we have to come out of our shell and stop being so individualized, because then we point the finger at others and say, well, you're being individual. Well, we can't be individuals. We can't be racist. We can't be isolated in ourselves and think the world revolves around us. We are dealing with a human problem right now. Wars, in the war on the battlefield or the war in the ghetto, is the same thing. It is the lack of value for human life, and that is what's crippling people everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one, just to push back a little bit, I think a couple of things. One, I think what's really interesting is that, you know, when you look back at the history of people of African descent, you know, sometimes we there are certain problems. Like if you look at prison, right, people see the mass incarceration as kind of a natural extension of what happens in a society. But if you go back to ancient civilizations, you know, certain civilizations don't even have a word for jail because they didn't need a jail, because the institutions and the communities were so strong that they didn't need it. And so a part of, I think, what we're tasked with is looking at societies and civilizations that were not sick, right, that didn't have the kind of ailments that we see in our society that for many of us are so natural because we grew up in a context where that's all we know and see. The other thing that I also think is important, because I think, you know, Munir is right in terms of these problems aren't problems that are black problems, but black folks are more vulnerable to the kinds of social ills that I think that we see. And we can see that at every, if you get data at every indicator of the welfare of a community, right, black folks are always at the bottom.
That's because we say we are at the bottom. Again, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you keep saying, I'm at the bottom, I'm at the bottom, I'm at the bottom, guess what? You wind up at the bottom. I come from the streets. There was no intervention to raise Munir Bahar to the next level of where I am now. down. No one came. I didn't get any government assistance. There was no new school built. There was no resource. There was no counselor. There was no aid. There was no federal assistance. I chose to walk a certain path. I chose to educate myself. I chose to do things because my mother told me that I could do those things. So in absence of all these external things that we say we need to save the community, we don't need these things. It is a problem when a man or woman believes that their solution lies outside of them. In the absence, we are not the first poor community. Let's take South Africa, for example, and under the apartheid regime. They didn't have beautiful institutions. They didn't have rec centers. They didn't have schools. They didn't have stimulus packages. They had will. They had morals. They had values, and they had belief that they would be free one day. That's all that's needed first. These other things are just extra additional additives that really do not take the place of the internal willpower that a people needs in order.
I didn't see anybody in here, so we only have so much time. But, Devon, I want you to finish what you're saying. I want to get to the phones.
Well, no, I was just going to say, again, I think it's important that when you have a group of people that, you know, in terms of the kinds of things that we see in our society that make black folks, that put black folks in the condition that we're in. And again, I think it's important for us to seek solutions from within. But it's also important to know the enemy that we're working with, and that it's not just a matter of the fact that we say. It's not that I say that black folks are more likely to be incarcerated, which is why black folks are more incarcerated than others. It's the fact that there's a society, there's a structure set up that does that. Now, that isn't an excuse for me not to say I need to build up myself so I can protect myself from those institutions. But it's to say, if we're going to be realistic about challenging the institutions that disempower folks, that it's important for us to know what we're dealing with, so we're not naively thinking that we're in a society that is no respecter of the fact that I'm a black man, sees me as a threat, and is interested in discarding me at every turn. And so that, again, that's not an excuse to say, you know, I'm woe is me, I'm poor, and I can't do anything, I need other people to help me. In fact, what I'm saying is the opposite, which is that we need to empower our own institutions so that regardless of what the state does to black folks, that we have the institutional power to protect ourselves.
I'm going to pull the arguments that both of you just made and see, because I think they're different, but they're not in some ways in the dialectics. I want to come, but let me get to the phones first. 410-319-8888. Michael Scott, you're on the air.
Hey guys. Great conversation on Biko's death date. You know, and the work that we do, we always say that we don't have to make that false choice to the last point made with the passion of the brother and also the logic of Devon, because you got to put personal responsibility into systemic context, right? So you're not, you don't get a pass for personal responsibility. But I mean, you know, part of our challenge is the lack of analysis and strategy that we have, even on a regional basis. So I was just in a conversation with all the planners, you know, in the seven metropolitan councils, not only just the planners, but the whole apparatus of government. It was one of the first times they've ever met, right? But yet, you know, when my father integrated Baltimore County school system, right, as a principal, there was still an active executive, a county executive marketing that county as a white-only county simultaneously, right? That has an effect, right? And so unless we have a regional, a fuller analysis to look at the systems in place that push against us, but to both of your brothers' points is that, you know, you've got to do the work. But part of doing the work is being really clear on the analysis and what the strategy is and how that plays out. You talked about South Africa. We were on the ground in South Africa when Mandela came out. And so let's be clear. Without Angola and Cuba fighting the South African army to a standstill so that they did not have military superiority, there is no ANC deal. And let's also be clear that the interests of the people in South Africa might have been better served with the PAC, but that was not palatable to Western interests at the time. And it frightened us, right? And business was made a smarter bet with Mandela. And I'm not going to second guess Brother Mandela, you know, because all he has to do is say 27 years and wipes that out. But my point is that there are complexities and systems in place and other things that we have to consider. And we can't take the easy answer. We do have to have responsibility. We do have to have passion. and we got to have our own institutions, but we need a better structural analysis and a set of principles that's worked in other places to guide us toward that self-determination. And so thank you all for having the conversation, because it's never an easy one.
No, it's not, Michael.
It's the one that's got to be had.
The next time you'll be sitting in the studio.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Anytime. It's always good to listen.
What Michael Scott was just saying, who does a lot of work with Equity Matters, he does a very important work in the city and around the country. Let's try to put these things together for a second. I mean, we live in a city where at least one third or more of the citizens of the city live in dire poverty. I mean, dire poverty, where the majority of our children live in poverty. And that has to be addressed. I think I understand that people have we all have kind of our individual framework that we can stand up to things. But Munir, with all due respect, I think what you've done with your life is incredible. You come through the street prison system, out community, built your life, built a world, become a citizen who's trying to take on the issues around you, and and I think that we all have to, like, stand up and recognize what you've done for you and for other men around you you've brought along. But are there not also these larger social, political issues that we all live in a community together that somehow we have to turn around and address? Or we can't just do it one by one.
Yeah, but strategy. In the beginning phases of a war, you don't focus on what your enemy has or doesn't have. You develop your soldiers. You develop internally. You get yourself strong. So before you can go down here and tell folks in poverty, let's go fight the institutions, well, let's analyze what you have in your house. How come your kids aren't eating, but you have a 62-inch TV screen. Okay, you have the latest iPod, the latest this, the latest that. You got to deal with home first. The reason why when someone does something in Baltimore, some type of rally against anything, you get 12 people. You get 12 people. Why? Because everybody else who you are so-called fighting for, they are home playing video games, watching their 62-inch TV screens while their children are outside with no clothes on.
Yeah, I hear your passion, my brother, and I disagree. Wholly disagree.
On the 12 people?
No, I
count.
Well, I understand you count, but maybe only 12 people were interested in what you were doing.
I don't mean what I'm doing.
Okay, well, I'm not meaning you.
I got
you
600 men to come out in Baltimore City.
And that's a conversation at a different time that is not really where I'm at right now in this conversation, because this conversation is about, first thing, we're not going to talk about the victims. And what the victims are doing, you know, the victims at home. Well, if someone worked and scraped and did what they had to do in order to get whatever they wanted to get, then they have every right to do.
While their children are not eating.
Hold on.
You're a victim. You're neglecting your financial responsibilities.
Okay.
You're a victim.
And so we all have what appears to be our social relations to what our explanations is about our communities. Got it. I'm just saying that, and to say that, you know, it's not a black thing, got that. I got all of that. You know, Mark knows very simply, I'm not anti-white, I'm unapologetically black. So I don't have a reason to sit here and allow anyone to suggest that every child of every household that has the means to entertain themselves in their house. I think what we have right now is, how do we get there? How did we get to 200 and something plus murders, I think was our original concept. Well, let's also look at the fact that if murders went up, did poverty go up?
Absolutely.
Are there more homeless people in our community? And what are the 12 people or the 350 people who are marching and doing what they're doing to do to make sure that we're feeding and assisting? And if we're not feeding, are we teaching them how to plant? Everybody has their own army and their own groups and their own people. But I think that we need to be very delicate, very, very delicate when we suggest that everyone that's sitting in their house who's not attending a meeting, who's not attending a rally, who's not attending a march, and I have been to more marches than – I've turned down more marches than most of you gentlemen have ever been to. And I know the effectiveness of them at times. But at the end of the day, if we're looking at the fact – and I don't count 200 and something murders this year. I count 1,900 murders in the last 5 years. 1,900 black men primarily have died in the streets of Baltimore. But at the same time, there's a large percentage of homelessness. There's a large percentage of dropout rates. So what we need to do is come together on whatever level that we're in, not to talk about the victim, not to talk about what the problem is inside. What are we going to do about it?
Well, and I would submit also, too, because this seems to be like a very heavily male conversation, that a lot of what's going on in terms of the family structure has to do with the woman in the home, regardless of the race. I find that most, in having worked with teenage girls in residential treatment, you got a lot of young women who are sexually assaulted and broken, and they are having these children, and they are the first teachers of these children, and nobody's addressing this issue. And one of the things, there are so-called feminist structures here in the city of Baltimore. I'm not going to name them, but what I find is oftentimes they don't reflect the demographic of the community, and that the communities that need this empowerment, these women that need this empowerment, are completely not engaged in that, but they are living hand-to-mouth survival. And what I'm wondering, as a human being, as a female here in the city of Baltimore, as a woman here in the city of Baltimore, when do we address that a lot of this poverty comes from women not being able to find gainful employment, not being educated appropriately, the lack of actual sexual education, you know, that gives women empowerment over their bodies, and thus they can teach their children responsibility, and also men in that. So the breakdown of the family is the central issue, but there are factors around the breakdown that promote the breakdown and that promote the school-to-prison pipeline. But a lot of this conversation has to include the family dynamic, which women are a central part of.
And I just wanted to say, I think one of the elements, I think, to Muneer's point, I think is really important, is that I think sometimes we frame many of the people who are victimized by these forces as victims. And I think it's really important that when we talk about empowering communities, that we approach them not as empowering victims, but getting people to actualize their own sense of agency, their own sense of being able to determine what happens in their own household, and that public policy is oriented around helping to empower people to do for themselves. Instead of because I think sometimes the framework for the conversation is such that we see folks as, you know, needing outside intervention to fix them, instead of saying we need to go and help people in our communities, in their homes, be able to be the drivers of their own destiny. I think that's really important, because I think what ends up happening is that you have a lot of people that talk about these issues but aren't intimately connected to the families and the communities that are most directly affected. And therefore, we have ourselves kind of spinning our wheels talking about the issue instead of actually representing the folks that are actually in the trenches dealing with the issues that people face.
If I may, Mark.
Then I got to get the phone to it. Somebody call.
Go ahead. I just think that we have to recognize two things. One thing, poverty pays. And if anyone's not aware that poverty pays, all you have to do is go through the neighborhoods and see how poverty is paying. And so, you know, we'll take the calls from there. But, I mean, let's not suggest that poverty isn't a big dollar issue.
410-319-8888. Quick calls here, because we have like 10 minutes left in this conversation. I do want to kind of try to wrap up where we've come to. Kalik and then Rico. Kalik, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We've done the forensics over and over again.
Every time.
The reason why as a community, we're not, for one thing, forensically minded. When you do forensics on something, you find out exactly what are the causal factors, and then you address them. You do prevention. And the reason that we are conscious enough to know what we know is, for one thing, we have been educated. We educate ourselves beyond what the common education is. We seek out consciousness. Well, we have to establish institutions of consciousness so we can do the forensics, and from the people that are produced by that system of consciousness, we establish institutions where we don't have this conversation. South Africa is not free because the people are not benefiting from the natural resources, and we have an enemy that is preventing that. So we have to look at our enemy. We have to make sure the enemy is not us, by being lackadaisical. So the establishment of institutions and not believing that politics is going to solve our problem. if I were mayor. A mayor is a politician. A mayor is caught up in politics. We have to operate outside of politics and do it ourselves as a people. Marshall Plan, yes, come together, establish a Marshall Plan fund that we the people control. We the people establish, control, and address it to build institutions controlled by us and not politicians who are fickle.
Khalid, thank you. Let's go to Cindy. We need a woman's voice in here. All these men calling in. Go to Cindy first. Cindy, you're on the air.
Thanks so much. Manira's point is a huge challenge to feminists, and I love it. I've been a feminist for 50 years, and I only have one thing to say, which is that feminists are not allowed into schools pretty much. We do have an empowering message for women, not victims. And one example is, if you're in a domestic violence situation, always get out of the kitchen first. When you realize you have that little much power, you begin from there, and you start to see that you can have even more power. I'm just giving you an example. The feminists do have an appropriate message for young women from the streets, and that we yes, we don't do enough, and I love you for saying that, but also the schools are still so conservative, they don't let feminists in.
I think there are a lot of feminists in the schools. I've seen these women work, and men too, because men can also be feminists. But the problem is that the curriculum is not structured to empower young women. And a lot of times what you get in schools are perpetuations of sex-based stereotypes that really aren't effective for today's world. And also, too, within the feminist circles, particularly in the city of Baltimore, we still haven't dealt with racism. I mean, you know, I've been in feminist circles where I said, well, the problem here is I'm the only black woman that comes. And when I bring other black women with me, they tell me they're not coming back. And I had, you know, and I want to bring experts in to talk about the majority of women here in Baltimore who happen to be of color. And the rebuke I got was, well, this person needs to be vetted. This is the response that we get from certain elements of the feminist community in Baltimore. So I get what you're saying. I do feel that feminism at its root is can empower people. But we still haven't solved that race issue within that community either. We definitely need to deal with the root issue here in Baltimore, which is poverty.
Well, you said poverty. So the question is here, and Rika, we'll get to your call in just a second. But the question is, what makes poverty?
Racism.
Not that simple.
Mark.
It is not that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It is not that simple.
Okay, Mark.
Racism exacerbates poverty.
Exacerbates poverty. Yes.
But poverty exists across racial lines in this country.
Yes. Poverty.
There are tens of millions of poor white people all through America.
We were talking Baltimore. I mean, if you
want to I'm saying poverty is not just. And there are poor people in Baltimore, in Baltimore County, and then Arundel County.
Yeah.
Who are
They're not letting too many of them in Baltimore County anymore. You know, they're changing that rule, too.
Okay, let me answer that.
Except actually, poverty is growing in Baltimore County because people are moving to Baltimore County.
You know, I know.
But poverty is a result of a people's lack of will and lack of empowerment. That's where poverty comes from. When you lose your essence, when you lose your understanding of the manipulation of the resources of the earth, which is what happened in the continent of Africa, okay? Because nobody came in Africa and moved everybody out of the way and said, we're going to steal all these diamonds and all these resources.
That's exactly what they did.
No. Listen, you would have had to usher in way much more. The result of the fall of the strongest empires of Africa, which I have studied to a T, the result of the fall of these empires were more from an internal source of conflict. Just like the great Shaka Zulu, who was he killed by? His own family.
His brother.
His own family. But this internal demoralization results in this feeling of I can't do anything. I deal with it every day. I'm not just here talking because it sounds good. I work with children from Southwest Baltimore every day. I deal with their parents. I see the decisions that they make. I watch them. I see what they pull up and drive in, but yet they come to us complaining that they can't pay a measly $5 a day for their child's enrollment. But I see what they're wearing. I see what they're doing. I'm sorry. It's internal first.
Let me just push. I'll let you jump.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's weird because, I mean, there are parts of it. There are certainly elements in our community that have issues in terms of doing the things that it takes to do right by themselves and their families. I just think that if you look at the history, the last 500 years of particularly the United States and the Western Hemisphere, and going back to the original question of poverty, I think it's important to understand that the images, the representations, those who control the institutions have been folks that have built institutions that wouldn't have socialized folks to be able to do the kinds of things that you're talking about. Like, you don't have to teach a worm what it takes to survive. You know, a worm comes into the world, knows what it has to do to extract the material resources to benefit itself. And so people don't naturally come into the world not having the impulse to do what it takes to survive. Something has to have had happened to make that people or that individual, that group, not do what it takes that is in its own interest. And I think while it's important for us to get back to a place where folks make the kind of decisions that will build their communities, it's important to understand what happened to Black folks in the United States. And going back to the question of poverty, when you look at, you know, what causes poverty, a bunch of things causes poverty. But at the root is that if you want people to have what it takes in order to protect themselves from poverty, then you have to have institutions to provide the necessary things that allow communities to be healthy. And if you don't have institutions, and we live in a society that's not going to give it to you. You know, this society is one where people take, right? We have a society where people are greedy. You know, people just want things for themselves. And so if you don't have institutions that will fight for the things that families need in order to protect their interests, then it won't happen. And I think that's the position that Black folks are in a way that is different. Not to say that there aren't other communities that don't have issues, that don't have their own issues in terms of society taking from them. But that is to say that we live in a society where Black folks are uniquely vulnerable in terms of not getting those resources. And so that means that's even more the reason why, as Black folks, we need to develop those institutions to get the things we need to survive.
We need to go to break here. We're going to come back into this conversation. We are going to go out with a song of Molly Maguire's, the Irish group I talked about during history, that fought for the rights in Pennsylvania by the Irish Balladeers. But on the way out here, when you throw that thing about as we come back, that poverty, it's in this country, poverty in Baltimore, part of it is created because we deindustrialized the city. Black and white people lost their jobs in the steel mills and were forced into poverty. Families were destroyed. That's part of poverty. Other part of poverty, to me, is white supremacy, where money is in the hands of an old white elite in America that still holds the money, and that's what causes poverty. But they work together, not separate. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
There is one man, a child of hell, a magistrate in the station.
Welcome back. That was Tchaikovsky's Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies and Nutcracker, first performed on this day in what year that was, I forget, but it was a while back on this Christmas season, so we play that right now. We are here with our four guests, and you are going to go right to the phones. Munir Bahar, activist and founder of Core Fitness, one of the organizers of the 300-Man March. Davon Love, director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Reverend Meredith Moyes, ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, one of the first women ordained in the Old Catholic, Black women ordained in the Old Catholic Church. And Michael Johnson, community activist, longtime community activist, and executive director and founder of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change, 410-319-8888. Two quick thoughts from our guests and come back so we can wrap up here with, I mean, from our listeners, we can wrap up with our guests. Judy, you're on the air, and then Rico. Judy, you're on the air.
Good morning.
You're on the air, Judy. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My comment is, I sit and I listen to this radio station. I've been hearing it for years and years. But you guess everybody's saying, I've been hearing it so much, I get so tired of it. We're gonna, we should. The main problem, what I've seen, and I've been robbed three times. And the last time a guy put a gun on my forehead, I'm blessed to still be alive. But the guys that I noticed that robbed me, none of them, not one of them looked like he had finished the seventh grade. I think what we did as a Black race, the mistake I believe that we made was when we had to read by candlelight, we had a lot of pride. But then when we got free school, nobody wants to know how to read anymore and get an education. The educational problem is what's causing a lot of this, the death that's going on, because a lot of the gang members, they don't finish high school. A lot of the guys who are robbing and killing people, they're not finishing school. Most of the people in this radio station, you know, I'll say all of your kids and your grandkids probably go to night school. But these uneducated children who are not made to go to school and sit on steps are going to come to the malls where your children are. You got to go back to where it started. This was designed to happen exactly the way it happened. Have a good day.
Thank you, Judy. Rico, you're on the air.
We went to South Africa to the moon on this conversation. I thought we were talking about the local murders. I have to agree with the young lady just called. You know, until the elected leadership all the way around, from the governor to the mayor, all of them, until they really have make a decision if they're going to do something with the poverty and these hopelessness that's coming up with these young men in this city, these murders are going to continue. I mean, these kids sitting out here killing each other over $10, $12 and stuff like that. If you park a Brinks truck in them neighborhoods and start hiring these kids and stuff like that and training these kids and educating these kids, you'll get something done. You got billion-dollar stadiums, million-dollar casinos, and broke people. And it's all about the elected leadership. They don't care. You can catch them down in the sky boxes and all of them like that with their mink coats on and everything else. And the city is falling apart. And Mark, great show. And let's keep hope alive.
Thank you, Rico.
Can I say something, Mark? And I'll be quick. But look, in reflection of the articles that you sent us by email, all right, one was about, you know, the murders. Then the other piece about the safe streets. And also reflecting back to what the challenge that we, the 300 Men March, put out to the men of Baltimore City this summer. Okay, we said, look, in absence of the elected whatever and whoever whatever that's not doing what, let's men stand up, occupy, and let's take over our neighborhoods. Men, let's do it. So we had 600 men come out to the first march on North Avenue. Hold on.
Well, we only have a couple minutes. Okay. I cancel the menu. I can't let you go on through a whole, like, five-minute speech.
Okay, all right. One more second. So the very next one, we said, now we're going into the hood. No cameras, no nothing. Numbers dropped significantly. Significantly. So we challenge the men of Baltimore to stand up. Let's do something in the absence of what we don't have. And what happens? We don't do anything.
Let's go around the table here. We got to close out. Michael?
Meredith?
Davon?
I think this was a very good conversation. And I appreciate your moral convictions and the convictions of everyone around this table for what everyone is saying. But at the end of the day, and once we start recognizing that poverty and the lack of services that other people get in other communities, you know, to suggest that we don't need services, then you're not going to say to Roland Park, don't clean your alleys. You're not going to say to Roland Park, don't have police protection. You're not going to say to Roland Park, I can put a liquor store or a conditional liquor store on every corner. We need employment. We need employment, and we need job training. And if we can get job training and employment and fix the institutions that are being paid to make repairs in our community, we'll be fine. And thank you, Mark, for giving us this forum.
Thank you, Mark. I think that poverty is the central issue to all of this. Poverty beats hopelessness and desperation. However, the institutions that exist in our community, and particularly coming from a faith perspective, the faith institutions like the churches and the temples and so on and so forth need to step up. Let's stop just using the buildings on Saturday and Sunday, and let's turn these places into multi-purpose centers that feed find people homes, create jobs, and work for the betterment of Baltimore.
Davon.
I think one of the biggest problems is that the narrative that's being told by the communities that are most victimized by this violence, that there are people, organizations, institutions that are doing work every day to try to address these problems, but they don't have access to the PR, they don't have access to the major institutions so that people would know about the work that's going on. And so I think what's really important is not that we try to come up with some new strategy to fix the problems in our communities, but empower those who are deploying things that are currently working working in these communities to empower them, to strengthen them. Because I think the problem is sometimes we have these conversations and we want to figure out what's the new thing we can do to fix the problem, when really the solutions to these problems are in the communities. It's a matter of giving them the resources and investing in the institutions that have the expertise to address these problems in order to fix the communities. And I think that's the kind of self-reliance in terms of the communities determining their own interests that's important for building communities to protect themselves and their own interests.
And I'm really curious. One of the things we didn't do in the course of this conversation was to explore some of these things, and some of these things I really want to get into in depth. Where you left off, we've never really had a conversation about what that means. You've talked about this in the show before as well. And I think that the other part that I think the show was lacking a little bit was, just to put out there, we need more voices of women on this show beyond Meredith. I mean, more people on panels like this who are also women. And I think that this calls for interaction with folks beyond the black community.
Absolutely.
To force a conversation that has to happen around the questions of power and all the other questions that we have. I think all these together, I mean, I think this is a series that we need to just keep doing. I would say, weekly if we have to, just to gather panels to have with no special agenda, but to talk about the agenda of the week and look at where we are. And I think that's very critical. And I want to thank all of you for two things. First, thank you for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
And second, thank all of you for the commitment all four of you have to making our community a stronger, better place. Whether we agree or disagree on certain issues and how we approach these issues, the key thing here is that there's not a person in this room that life is not dedicated to making the lives of other people better.
Amen.
And to building up rather than tearing down. And I think that that's the importance of a conversation like this. I mean that sincerely for everybody in this room. Thank you, Davon Love. Always a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Becoming a regular here, which I like, Manu Bihar. Always good to have you here, man.
Thank you.
I love your passion. I love you. You're a beautiful brother. Thank you for being here in the studio. My dear friend Meredith Morris, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Always blessed to have you in the studio. And my old friend Michael Johnson.
Oh, I'm catching up, Dan.
Yeah, you'll never be as old as me, but
I know,
you're
catching
up.
I'm catching up.
Thank you all four for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about what's new in the city paper.